there's a lot that doubted us, and it's, I'm being very honest, you know, why would you turn your back on, you know, something that you've known all these years? All sorts of comments for like, you guys are never going to make it, and whatever. We're still here.
Welcome to the 378th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. On a recent summer afternoon, Noreen Thomas and I walked in a grassy buffer separating a small creek and a field of soybeans growing on her farm in northwestern Minnesota. The organic beans were thriving in the dark, rich soil of this field, which, like so much land in the Red River Valley, was as flat as a pancake. Leopard frogs were leaping beneath the soybean canopy, and the grassy buffer was buzzing with insect life. After a few minutes, we rounded a bend in the creek and came upon a fenced-in one-acre plot of thriving tall plants with bright yellow flowers and thin stems. This was a four-year-old stand of perennial sunflowers, a plant Noreen's Downing Thomas Farms is helping USDA researchers study. Noreen was visibly excited by the potential of this plant to diversify the landscape here in the heart of monocrop agriculture. It resembles the traditional sunflower plant, but can be grazed as well as pressed for oil. She likes the idea that such a crop doesn't have to be replanted year after year and can be grown without chemical inputs. That's the new agriculture, Noreen said at one point. During the short time I spent on the 1,200-acre cropping operation Noreen and her husband Lee own, it became clear to me that she thinks a lot about what role new ideas can play in creating a better, more resilient agriculture. Noreen has been thinking that way since she married Lee in 1987 and they began farming together. The land has been in Lee's family for six generations, and for much of that time, it was pretty much a conventional cropping operation. But Noreen became concerned about how reliant on chemical inputs a typical Red River Valley farm is. She has a degree in food and nutrition, microbiology, and chemistry from North Dakota State University, and for a time worked in the state chemistry lab. That experience, along with her passion for nutrition, prompted Noreen to look into growing crops without the use of agrochemicals. She also says that economically, farms like hers face three choices: get bigger, sell out, or find a niche. They chose option three. It wasn't easy. At the time, the Thomases only knew of one organic farmer in the area. But through trial and error and the assistance of a sympathetic extension educator and a few university researchers, Downing Thomas Farms started transitioning into organics in 1997. During this transition, Noreen and Lee overcame both agronomic and marketing obstacles to build a successful regenerative operation. For example, they've utilized cover cropping and diverse rotations to more than triple their soil's organic matter levels in some cases. And Downing Thomas is now well known for the variety of certified organic crops it raises and the various markets it's been able to access. Besides soybeans, the farm also produces rye, wheat, oats, millet, buckwheat, corn, and barley. Years ago, Noreen took classes on selling into export markets, and the farm has developed a consistent list of buyers for their crops here and abroad. About a dozen years ago, the Thomases became known for their involvement in another aspect of agriculture. After experimenting with selling items such as wheat made from their small grains, Noreen realized there was a direct-to-consumer market for value-added products. The operation now has some of their grains milled and packaged by specialty processors and sells various kinds of flour, a seven-grain cereal, and oat groats to local eaters and restaurants, as well as to buyers in other parts of the country. Noreen even has a relationship with the New York-based celebrity chef, regenerative ag advocate, and author Dan Barber. In spite of that brush with fame, Noreen remains committed to local food systems. The day I visited Downing Thomas, she had just returned from delivering 300 pounds of flour to a bakery in the region. Noreen and Lee remember well how difficult it was to diversify their farming operation, get into organics, and even start selling value-added products. That's why in recent years, they've been working to help the next generation of farmers who want to follow a non-conventional path. They're now renting their crop ground to two brothers who are in their 30s, and Noreen serves as a senior fellow at the University of Minnesota Moorhead. In that capacity, she's working with 10 beginning farmers to help them with everything from marketing and financial management to figuring out how to navigate government programs. Some of these beginning farmers are new immigrants, and Noreen also works with local programs that support indigenous agriculture, as well as nutrition, and community food systems. And as the perennial sunflower example shows, Noreen is still very interested in utilizing her science background to research innovative approaches to farming. Besides the USDA, she's worked with researchers at the University of Minnesota. She's even partnered with North Dakota State University engineering students on a project related to robotic weed control. Despite her very busy schedule, Noreen sat down long enough to chat with me a bit about why they took the organic route, the importance of mentoring the next generation of farmers, and what changes are needed if products made from organic and niche crops are to become a bigger part of the food system. We also talked about why the farm's name is fitting in more ways than one.
So the farm is pretty diverse. The farm's 1,200 acres in the valley, and as he said, flat as a pancake. So we do a diverse amount of crops. So there's rye, there's wheat, there's oats, there's barley, there's soybeans. On occasion, there's corn, blue corn or yellow corn. Little bit of millet, too, in there. And the crop rotation is a little bit longer than average. You know, sometimes it's back-to-back in conventional farms. They do corn and soybeans, but we do more diverse. And we use the cover crops like winter wheat. We use a combination of things. We also use rye, which really helps keep up here the wind blows all the time. So it keeps that soil in place.
You got started, you and Lee got started, or you've been farming since around the 1980s, and you started transitioning into organics in 1997. Can you talk a little, it was a pretty conventional operation before that. What prompted the trans, because that was, organics wasn't brand new, but there weren't, you said there was maybe one other organic farmer in this area back then, and so hence the name Downing Thomas. People were really doubting why you would transition to this. What prompted you to look into organics and make such a big change, and to stick with it, really, through thick and thin?
And I think a farm at one point were looking at either get it larger, buy more land, find a niche, or sell out to the neighbors. Yeah. And so finding a niche, and I was also very interested in organics just with that kind of emerging, that market. I just felt better about eating foods. I'm kind of the person that's hypersensitive about different foods. So I just, having clean food for health, I just feel a lot better.
Back then, where were you getting information on how to do organics? I mean, this is the Red River Valley, so it's the heart of conventional sugar beets, and yeah, now more recently corn, but also soybeans has been here for a long time, that type of thing.
Yeah, I think from the other farmer, and this wonderful man, Jim Stordahl, was extension agent, and he was doing organics a little bit. But he would dive in and find the information that we needed. And he actually applied for grants so that we could use some of these different ideas that we had. And Paul Porter out of the University of Minnesota, which I just love, he came along and he said, you know, I think we should do rye and soybeans. No one back then did that. And now it's across the board, farmers do that.
And it sounds like building soil health was super key to all this. That was really the foundation for all of this in making any kind of a transition and making it so it will be resilient year after year.
Exactly. And I always felt in my heart of hearts that, you know, we test for three different things in the soil, but we're missing a whole lot of other things that are in the soil. It can't be that simple. So the idea is to work with it and build that up. Better soil, better food for people to eat as well.
So you had to do a lot of, in the early years, a lot of your own market research, figuring out where you were going to sell this stuff, and making connections with buyers. Can you talk a little bit about kind of how challenging that was? One of the reasons people don't go for a niche or don't do something like organics is it's pretty easy just to take that stuff into town to the elevator. And you couldn't do that then. You can't even do it now with organics or something, a specialty crop like that.
Yeah, and you actually, you know, cold calls, going to conferences, you know, reading labels, looking at like, who do you think would be buying organic? And just really searching through, building relationships with them too. That when I send them a sample or when I tell them that the protein is 14% or something that it really is, because integrity is everything, especially when you deal with buyers across the board, conventional and organic, but especially with organic too, that you do have your certificate, you're not cheating the system, all that, because you'll have one black eye if you do that and they'll never come back.
Yeah. And you were, even with international buyers, you were dealing kind of directly with that, it sounds like?
Yes, absolutely. And they love Midwest farmers. They don't like some of the companies, but they love the farmers. So we found it very warm and welcoming that we were their farmer, that it was kind of a position of honor to provide food for the people. Hmm. So it was very different for us.
So around a dozen years ago or so, you kind of started getting more into the value added end of it. I think it's, tell that story about how you took some stuff to the farmer's market and you kind of used it, not just, you're not like, well, I'm going to make a fortune off the farmer's market here. You kind of used it as consumer or marketing research a little bit.
Yes, we were just starting up a farmer's market in downtown Fargo, and I think there were 7 of us, maybe 13 at most. And so I had these really ugly craft bags. And I thought, okay, if this product, this rolled oats or this flour sells, then I'm onto something, because then they're looking at the ingredient of it. So it was a great way to try it out. And not only that, then I decided to up my packaging, and I didn't know which color, what font. I mean, there's so many decisions going into that. And so I would play around with that and show them different things and say, you know, tell me which one do you like? And strangers are so much more honest than even family, you know, when it comes to that. And they would tell you, like, no, I really don't like this, or this package is too big, or, and then I'd ask them straight out, how much would you pay for this? They actually priced it higher than I was going to. So it was like, aha, moment. So we began doing that, and then pretty soon some of the stores said, well, what are you going to do in winter? Why don't you just put your product in our store? So that's how it kind of launched. So I think we're at 23 stores right now.
What are some of the products you got?
We have 7 grain cereal, rolled oats, and oat groats, rye, wheat, barley flour, and we also make a pumpernickel flour. It's kind of a rougher. Hmm. And then oat groats that are like rice, but so much better for us.
Yeah. And I hate to name drop, but you name dropped. Dan Barber has been to this farm, and you have a connection with him. And you kind of are able to kind of sell stuff to him, but also bounce ideas off of him of hey, well, try this out. Talk about that. That's a pretty significant. He's very influential, for people who don't know. He's a very influential chef out of New York. And when he likes something, people listen.
Very much so. And he's very much on that creativity. I mean, he's very interested in that. So Dan is very helpful to us, even growing things for him, even for his seed company. We've done that for vegetable seeds for him. So it was a partnership that really is great. We also work with chefs out in California that run 7 restaurants. We work with chefs in Minneapolis. A lot of them have gotten national awards that they're looking for, that creative source. And so I can provide them something that tastes different and enriches their life as well.
I feel like, talking to you a little bit, that you're kind of in an exciting point in your career, in that you and Lee right now are renting your farm to two younger brothers, I think they're in their 30s, who are interested in organics. And so you're able to kind of look at the next generation a little bit. And also you're working with other farmers in the area to source some products for some of your value-added stuff. That must give you a little bit, because you really were striking out in the kind of as a pioneer. It must be kind of satisfying to see that interest and to see, okay, this is going to have legs maybe after I'm not around anymore, or, you know, that there is a way to kind of pass on that interest, and that there's an interest on the part of the eater, but also on the part of younger farmers.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, you want to be, I want to be that mentor I wish I would have had. And my strong points would be, you know, to be creative and think about markets for them that they haven't think of. Maybe that barley needs to go for a dog food. Maybe they need that buckwheat to go to the Asian families. So I think I'm always you know, looking at what people are eating, what are the trends. And I think that's where the chefs come in. They're always watching for trends. We had the most fun. One of our posts, we had a chef that wanted to do some grilling, but they never used charcoal in Scandinavian families. They used hay. So we raised this hay with 7 different things in it, and she was out there grilling her vegetables. And I think within the first day, we had 1,000 likes on it because it was so crazy. We had other chefs, you know, can we get some more of that hay? And sure, you can. And so keeping up with that is also, it is a lot of joy.
Looking at kind of your involvement with both the production end and kind of the marketing end and the consumer end of the organic food movement, that type of thing, and small grains and getting that integrated into the system, what are some big areas that you feel like we still need to advance in order to see more of this be part of the food and farm system? It seems like that's one of the things that you really feel strongly about, going all the way back to when you were at that farmer's market, is more consumer education about, because people, they say they want to eat better, but then maybe we need to take one step further and say, well, this is how you can follow through on that. That sounds like that's one big one right there.
Absolutely. And the families, and I think start young. I mean, the white bread era happened like a generation ago. And to get the kids into more of the whole grains, or even whole grains for, you know, pancakes or anything, people will always eat grains. It's one of the most stable foods that all we eat all across the world. So if we just bring it back to more of a whole grain, something that tastes good, I think with the plant breeders, the processing too. I mean, it's silly that, you know, we have some mills, but in Minnesota, they're 2.5-3 hours away. So we're right in the bread basket. Why don't we have a mill here and make it localized? Because we have not learned from COVID. We had a slapdown where the farmers had wheat in their bin and the consumers had no flour on the shelves. This is food security. Yeah. It's a national defense too. And I feel very strong about that. I also feel, and I've talked to the defense secretary for the U.S. government, and he agrees that also to our military, we feed them garbage. Who's ever the lowest bidder gets the, you know, and I'm like, what? You guys are, you know, you're supposed to be helping with defense here. So he agrees. So actually Minnesota is going to roll out some interesting project for that, because we're starting to see the effects of not eating well.
So that's two big areas kind of, is we need more consumer education and figuring out a processing system that's maybe more localized. So we don't have to ship it all over. Yes. Is there another big area like to help farmers kind of get transitioned into some of these systems and make it economically viable for them?
Yeah, also the transportation. If you're just, you know, moving some product and it's smaller, you're not the big companies, you know, you're kind of competing with them for transportation point. And we're working on that actually with Extension to do some backloads, because the trucks go back to the cities empty. So if the farmers can put some of their product on there.
So if you're a farmer, no matter where you are, not just in the Red River Valley, say southwestern Minnesota, central Iowa, or wherever, who is in the middle of corn soybean country, you are looking to maybe not even go organic right away, but just trying to get a small grain into that rotation and figuring out how to do it economically, viably. Any advice on what are some of the kind of first steps or things that they should be, even before they take a step, start thinking about to kind of diversify that system and not lose out at the bank big time?
I think also looking at what are your machinery, what are your skill levels, what are the requirements, what are the buyers looking for? Talk to buyers before you even think about it. Because maybe, like, for instance, blue corn, they've got a supply for another year. So that wouldn't be a good choice to grow blue corn. So looking at the markets, what's required of you? Look at the weather. What is a weather pattern? Is drought predicted? You know, is it going to be a really wet summer? Kind of looking at that and what you can plant to kind of offset.
And I guess if you're going to take that next step, maybe small grains have fit into your system and you'd like to maybe take more control of the economic end of it a little bit and do some processing. I mean, any advice on that? that's something that you're still maybe, you said ideally you'd like to have a mill on the farm here. You don't right now. You're shipping that out. So I know that's a little bit frustrating, but still you have stepped into that value added processing in a pretty big way. Any thoughts on that?
Do your market research to add a value. Like, what are your competitors doing? Is it out of country? Is it a national person? What can you do better? It's probably going to wind up too with flavor. Because at the end of the day, they'll remember your flavor over anything. So selecting seeds and varieties that are flavorful or that chefs want or your end user wants. All wheat is not equal. There's very, very different flavor profiles on each. And some you want a lower protein that maybe you're just doing a like a pancake mix or something like that. And test it out. Try it at your farmer's market too. And with processing, go with others. Don't do it alone and say, well, we're going to try this, you know, maybe two or three of us. If it doesn't work, you can always get out without much loss.
Well, and I guess the number one rule is if you're going to do something like this, remember that you're raising food, which sounds like a no-duh thing, but so much of the bulk of agriculture in the Midwest is focused on that raw commodity, and we forget that there's a food connection there. And it sounds like that was an important piece for you, was that food connection.
Definitely. And, you know, not using the shovel that you just shoveled manure with. So just making sure you're doing things safe. You know, and what are the regulations to make sure you are very aware of what's required. Like, especially when you get greens, there is a lot of Artisan Grain Collaboration has some really great fact sheets on what's required, knowing that. And your secondary market, you know, okay, if I don't make the mark, where am I going to take this grain for feed market?
There was one thing that I just thought of that you mentioned that I thought was really important. It was we were talking about weather. And you've become a hyper attentive student of weather and not just, you're really thinking even a year ahead. You're really can you talk a little bit about that? Because that can determine your marketing plan, what you're going to plant, what kind of seed you're going to buy, all that thing. That I thought that was really interesting.
So I'm following the market. I'm talking to a meteorologist, and every state has a meteorologist that's appointed to give you that information. So it's not like I'm having to put another person on staff. So I routinely ask what the models are showing. So if they're saying like drought, and then I also look, for instance, last year drought in Colorado was a good probability. Well, they grow a lot of millet. Maybe we should look at millet contracts. And sure enough, it just happened to work out. Or are the patterns very wet, wet, wet? Or should I get a winter wheat or a rye on the ground in fall because moisture is going to be a concern next summer? So I can make it through that spring with the snow melt, right. But that's about it. So then you're always planning and looking ahead. And varieties, some varieties are more susceptible to disease too if it's a very wet year. I'm not going to probably grow in something like Red Fife that is more susceptible. It's too much of a risk for me.
So is there anything that's kind of has you excited out there as far as innovations in small grains production or organic production or even on the market end or processing, some things that you're like on the horizon that you think are really exciting?
Yeah, I think perennial, it sounds odd, but perennial sunflowers is growing on our farm as an experiment. It's kind of a egg in 10 years. And the sunflowers are tough. They come back every year. They're small stalks, so you can actually eat the stalks. You can make tofu from them. And you can also, women's cosmetics are made from the sunflower oil. And you look at the world events, Ukraine used to ship in a lot of sunflowers. Well, there's a need for sunflower right now. So this perennial, you can graze it after you've harvested it, and then it comes back the next year. And it's grown with little care, no fertilizer. We don't water it, and it looks very promising, so I'm very excited. And the whole, it's beautiful, all the sunflowers. Mm-hmm. The pollinators in that are over the top. We had USDA come out, entomologist, and he said, I'll probably find a few things. And he came back and said, no, I found a lot of things. So that's a really fun one. And I think diverse crops, as we get a lot of people here from other countries, we have millet, sorghum, things like that are in their diets and they're used to that. So I think we're going to see some niche, not a lot of demand for it, but still niche markets in that.
Going back a little bit to the mentoring, it sounds like you kind of have, it sounds like maybe it's informal, but you have a pretty good system set up of, you've networked with these younger farmers, beginning farmers, and you're kind of offering services for them, everything from helping them out with government programs to, you know, going with them to the bank. That people get excited about farming and they think, I just want to farm, I'm going to raise that crop or whatever. They don't think about all the other things. But you are such a wealth of information on, like you said, you want to be the mentor that you didn't have, kind of thing. I think that's really a key piece, is to have somebody in the community who's farming the same soils and the same climate that they're farming, dealing maybe with the same market situation, that can just kind of, they can just kind of be a go-to a little bit.
Yeah, so the University of Minnesota had me as a senior fellow, so I have another year of it, but I would do it anyway. And I realized that especially the farmers, beginning farmers, really needed, if they didn't come from a farm family, really, or even if they did come from the farm family, to really needed that surrounded, holistic, the bank, the USDA office, all those things link into farming. And the certification, if they choose to go organic, can be overwhelming. And sometimes it's just nice to talk to somebody and say, what should I do about this? Or I don't know how to do this. And I'm kind of that sounding board, you know, to say, well, I don't know, but I'll look it up or I'll find someone to help you, because they're so overwhelmed with just the production. You have to do all the other things. So it's kind of my gift, and I'm hoping that they then turn around and help somebody later.
Sounds like including some new immigrant farmers in the area.
Yes, I have two brothers, and they're amazing. So they're from Southeast Africa. And, you know, we did a business plan for them. We did their logo. We did also their name. They couldn't think of a name. And I said, what about Two Brothers, you know, vegetable farm? Oh, okay, that's it. You know, we love that. Yeah. So, and we found the schools are going to buy from them this year. I have two schools that came on, and they're thrilled because they're just starting. They're all excited, and it's just great. And they told me, they said to me, sometimes, Noreen, we need you to help us figure this out or go with us.
Yeah.
Because they feel self-conscious of the English. And it's like, no, sure, I'll go. To them, kind of the grandmother in their culture is very important. And so all of a sudden when I said I was a grandmom, I got extra kudos. So I think, yeah.
So final question. The name of your farm is Downing Thomas Farm. You seem very positive, so I'm a little bit surprised at the name.
Yeah, so Doubting Thomas came, last name being Thomas, but there was a lot that doubted us, and a lot of even family. I mean, I'm being very honest, was doubting. And, you know, why would you turn your back on, you know, something that you've known all these years? And all sorts of comments for like, you guys are never going to make it, and whatever. We're still here. So Doubting Thomas, and I still think of that because, yeah, I'm probably one that doesn't doubt a lot. You know, I kind of will put it out there. If it doesn't work, I'll just retract and try something else. And to others, that's just a little too painful.
By the way, Doubting Thomas Farms' Facebook and Instagram accounts are good places to follow some of the innovative work the operation is involved in, including recent research into robotic weeders. You can find links to those social media accounts at DowningThomasFarms.com. For more information on diversifying cropping operations, including details on LSP workshops related to the topic, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 378 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. It helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, Visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.